This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Governor's Council on a Council for People with Disabilities has set up the month of March as Disability Awareness Month across the state. And given that adults and children with disabilities make up just over 19% of the Hoosier State's population, disability awareness is important for all of us. There are some events that are coming during the month here in Northwest Indiana. One of them is coming, on March 29th in Gary, where the Mayor's Organization for Disability is going to have a luncheon to recognize Northwest Indiana disabled folks and the people who support them as well. But today, there's going to be a very special event happening in Michigan City. And the Michigan City Human Rights Commission is helping kick off Disability Awareness Month with a very special reception coming up this afternoon. It'll be involving the Michigan City area schools and Michigan City Mayor Ron Meir. And he is with us from his office at City Hall to talk about the event and as well as Disability Awareness Month. Mayor Meir, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us the importance to you as not only the mayor of Michigan City, but as a resident of Michigan City and in LaPorte County as well, to recognizing that those folks who are disabled are not just ones to, certainly not to be pitied, or just to be recognized as inspiration to others. It's to accept them as citizens.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, we've taken a lot of efforts so that people with disabilities can have a normal life here, and there is a lot of challenges that we work on, but we are way ahead of things here in Michigan City in regards to like ADA compliance and things of that nature. But like you've mentioned, the Michigan City Human Rights Commission is very active, along with the school system, and there's just some great folks in these institutions that are really, really dedicated, and it touches everyone's lives. This folks that have these type of issues and disabilities affect everyone's life, including myself.
Tell us a little bit about the Michigan City area schools and their special education program that makes you as the mayor and other city officials so very proud of it.
Yes, and I want to mention also that the City of Michigan City does everything that we can do to accommodate the Michigan City area school system with their programs. With my department heads are at their disposal. There's a lot of interaction, particularly with the Michigan City Police Department and the Fire Department, working, being around the students, letting people feel comfortable around city officials and law enforcement. Great working relationship with Dr. Easton Watkins. Between my department's heads and myself and the school administration. But you know what? It's really inspirational, like, to see the results of the special attention that is given to certain children and to see them interact in the community. And I think one of the most rewarding things was to see some of the kids at the high school just embrace some of the young men and women who have disabilities. Where there had been some issues in other communities where children are ostracized or kind of shunned, it's exactly the opposite in the Michigan City area schools. And that's can really give you goosebumps to see these young folks really adapt and work with some of the children that have disabilities.
I know that's one of the major concerns that parents have, especially if they do have youngsters who are disabled, that they're going to be able to blend in well, or at least certainly interact well with their fellow students when they go to school. They don't want to be ostracized, and they don't want to have to spend time in special facilities if they don't have to for education. They want to be able to be in with the rest of the students in the schools, and I know Michigan City works very hard to be able to do that, doesn't it?
Well, you're right, and that makes us proud in our community to see that that type of activity is the rarity of where someone is being mistreated or something. And I think that goes a long ways by the teachers, instructors that are involved, and interacting with the other students, and to see it. Like I said, I've seen it firsthand where the athletic teams or the cheerleaders and things of that nature in our community have embraced these folks. And it's everybody is just one great family, and so that's real important. And I think that the Michigan City area school system and our community can be proud of that, because, like I say, we do hear of other stories in other areas and things, and I suppose it can happen anywhere where people are ostracized or not treated in the proper way, and that's just unacceptable. And We really put an emphasis on in Michigan City to make sure that those kind of things don't happen.
Now, Mayor Mirror, we know that the reception that is scheduled for the afternoon is sort of a thank you to the special education employees with the Michigan City Area Schools is one event getting through the month here. What else is planned that you know of that the Human Rights Commission is wanting to put on during the month of March to be able to showcase Disability Awareness Month?
Well, like you mentioned, today's event is at the school administration building, which starts at 2:30. And you know, that's really special recognition for the people we've just mentioned, the instructors and teachers in our school and the commitment from our school board and the collaboration between them and the Michigan City Human Rights Commission. I don't know if I can say mention all of the events that are going on, but I do know Jeff Deitch, the director of human rights here in Michigan City, who's right here in City Hall, does have an itinerary of other events that are going to be occurring throughout the month. I do believe there will be some interaction with some other cities and county officials also. I know I heard you mention something about Gary having several events too, and so I know that several of those are planned, and I'm certain that I'll be asked to speak at some of them.
That's great. Well, Mayor, thank you very much for being with us to talk about what Michigan City has to offer to its citizens and not only the Michigan City Area Schools with the special education program, but other activities as well, too, where residents of Michigan City can not only show their support to those who are disabled, young people as well as old, but a chance to be able to observe Disability Awareness Month. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today about this.
All right. Thank you very much. And it was very nice having this conversation. And Michigan City is a very welcoming community, and there's a lot of great things happening. So I invite everyone to please visit.
And we'll be back with you soon to talk about some of those things. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Indiana Dunes Tourism, which is the agency that supports tourism and convention activities in Porter County, put out its annual report not long ago on the economic impact of visitors to the attractions and businesses in 2016. We had a chance to talk with Lorelei Weimer, who's the executive director of Indiana Dunes Tourism, about that report that was put out by Certec.
We started working with Certec in 1994, but then in the early 2006, we started realizing that we needed to update these economic impact reports every other year, because we have businesses that are looking to move into the community and they're looking for up-to-date information. And so we've been working with Certec closely for years and being able to compare, you know, what's the travel and tourism industry look like economically from 2 years previously. And what's been great about our industry is it continues to show a very positive growth. And even during the worst times of the recession in 2008, we still had a slight growth. So, you know, people love to travel, and they don't want to give that up. So in this latest study, the visitors that are coming into Porter County, they're pumping in, and this is new dollars that they're bringing into our communities, is $413 million annually.
That's phenomenal. you can't ask for much better than that, unless it were for more, I suppose. But the idea is that it is interesting that there are so many people that are taking advantage of Porter County's tourism, the visiting places they can go to see, and that's aside from the Indiana Dunes themselves, isn't it?
Exactly, and you know, one of the things is the Indiana Dunes is by far the driver. I mean, it's what puts us on the map. It's what gets people to want to come here, and they bring in 3 million visitors a year just to Indiana Dunes. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about real spending, the spending's taking place south of the dunes. So the dunes will bring those visitors in, but we got to get people excited about our great communities and all the things that are offered in those communities. So that's where our job is to get them to the dunes, but also to get them south of the dunes. We like to say shake off the sand, south of the dunes. It's where they really spend that money.
Take a moment, if you will, Lorelei, and tell us about some of the places that the report may mention and that you certainly have mentioned in the past and can bring us up to date on some of these interesting spots that people that maybe stop at the Indiana Dunes, either to the National Lakeshore or to both the State Park and the National Lakeshore, I suppose. But you say they come south in Porter County to check out these other attractions. Tell us what seems to attract people south of the big highways.
Sure. Well, what people are looking for, and this is really important, is they're looking for things that are unique that they can't get in their own backyard. So they're looking for those dining experiences. The most dollar that is spent by the visitor, which is 38%, is on food and beverage. So they're looking for those restaurants that are unique that you can't get anywhere else. So they're not looking for the chains. So we have some great restaurants throughout Porter County. They're also looking for those attractions that you also can't get elsewhere. Like we have, not everybody has an IMAX sitting in their backyard. Not everybody has a Bass Pro sitting in their backyard. The 49er Drive-In Theater, a Bison Ranch, Valpo Velvet, who makes their own homemade ice cream, Valparaiso University. So those are some of the big gems that we have that we like to showcase to visitors.
Did the SurTech report in its recommendations, I'm sure, mention anything in particular that Indiana Dunes Tourism can enhance or should be doing to help not only boost tourism in Porter County, but in turn the dollars that come in?
Basically, what the SurTech study is showing us is who is your market? Like, who are those visitors? What's that average age? What's the travel size? So it's more about the data and is it matching up with some of the things that we're doing on the marketing side of it. So to give you an example, how we use that data is when we saw that the majority of the dollar from that visitor goes to food and beverage, and we have another study that shows us that we ranked low in quality or unique restaurants, we knew that we have great restaurants. So we knew that we have the product. So it was more of a marketing issue that we needed to make sure visitors knew that we had these great restaurants. So that's how we take this kind of data and we use it and say, okay, if we have these great restaurants, but the visitors don't know about it, then it's our job to figure out how to make sure that we elevate those restaurants and tell that story. So that's how we use that information.
Obviously ways that it can help a business out that don't necessarily require advertising dollars, although maybe they're small businesses, they're doing well, they put all of their assets and all of their work and efforts into making the business grow and to keeping it going, but you can help them out a little bit with a little bit of promotion, eh?
Absolutely, and that's what our job is, and you said something very important, small businesses. Majority of the businesses that are within Porter County as a destination, they really are small mom-and-pop businesses. And, our job is to come alongside of them and help get additional people through their doors. And so, we want to keep those doors open, and we want to be a part of helping them be successful.
Now, I know that the SurTech report covers a number of facets, as well as talking about economic impact. It also talks about employment. Tell us what the latest report had to say about what kind of jobs might be in Porter County that are basically attributed to tourism and to that sort of a product.
Absolutely. There's 5,075 residents that are employed because of travel and tourism. And it's through all the different sectors, because what you have to understand is that money that comes in from the visitors trickle down. So businesses are using the money from the visitor to pay NIPSCO maybe they need to buy linens or they need to buy supplies. So that starts to trickle through the economy. They have construction that they have to do. So it is a lot of the jobs that are being created are professional. And so it's an important part of what we do in travel and tourism is that we provide jobs. And, people need jobs. So this is a great industry in terms of being able to provide people that employment.
Now, Lorelei, in the time we have left here to talk today, can you give us an idea of, since this is usually the slow period here that the winter months are, you have, of course, some activities that are involved in tourism in Porter County during the winter months. But since we've had such an unusual winter this year, what kinds of things do you look forward to? And are you getting ready to promote going into when warmer weather does officially come back?
This is actually what we consider our busy time, because as an agency, we're geared up to make sure that when March comes, and March is the time most people start to plan for those summer trips, and we're a great summer destination. So we're putting all of our energy into our digital marketing right now. We've got our activities guide just getting ready to go to press.
That's Lorelei Weimer with Indiana Dunes Tourism. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports that the Urban League of Northwest Indiana is offering free tax preparation for low and moderate income residents. It could mean a big savings for some.
The Urban League of Northwest Indiana is offering help to people who need to get their tax returns filed. The cost is free, but it is based on your income. You have to make $54,000 or less. The help could save participants between $100 to $300 depending on each return. Tercina Jones coordinates the program with the Urban League of Northwest Indiana.
Well, it means that money that they would have had to pay to have their taxes done, now they can use it for other things. They don't have to worry about having to give up paying bills or other things, in order to have their taxes done. So they really appreciate the service. We get many compliments about how happy they are that the service is provided.
The program is sponsored by the United Way of Porter County and the Northwest Indiana Community Action Group. They have helped 500 people per year for the past 4 years. IRS-trained volunteers help prepare the returns on Monday and Tuesday by appointment only, and make sure to bring your ID. The program lasts until April 10th. They still need volunteers. You can call the Urban League of Northwest Indiana for more information. Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Consumer Protection Division of the Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill's office is recommending Hoosiers exercise caution when they're looking at considering tax refund advances or those tax refund-related loan programs. Some of the options are commonly offered, of course, by well-known tax preparation service companies, but some are not. And the CPD has received complaints this month about both the traditional loans and debit cards that are funded with tax refund advances. They become very popular offers. In one complaint, a consumer had reported to the state of incurring $235 per transaction fees when withdrawing money from the card under certain circumstances. That consumer got $70 in fees to access his money. In another, a consumer had reported that he had used the tax prep service thinking that he'd qualify for a tax refund-related loan, but then he later found out he did not qualify for that loan. And the consumer paid more than $400 for the company's tax preparation services, thinking that he would benefit from a tax refund-related loan that he ultimately didn't get. The state's Consumer Protection Division urges Hoosiers to be very careful if they choose an advance or loan when they're filing their taxes with a tax prep service. Be sure to ask questions and carefully review all of the terms of the programs. A bill that is moving from the Indiana House to the Indiana Senate this week would expand the number of vaccinations that Indiana's pharmacists may give to patients. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Sarah Fenton reports it's the latest evidence of the profession's growing role in the healthcare industry, but the possibility raises the question, are patients sacrificing quality for convenience?
Pharmacies used to simply be a place where you could pick up your pills and maybe a cane or a page of stamps. But these days, pharmacy services are expanding.
And the role of the pharmacist has absolutely changed.
Jennifer Burley is a patient care coordinator for Kroger Pharmacies. That means she's in charge of ensuring pharmacists administer all their procedures properly.
I think we've gone from a traditional dispensing role where we had no involvement really in the care other than giving the patient exactly what was ordered to having more responsibility where there's actually shared responsibility.
For example, Kroger now offers more preventative services such as cholesterol or blood pressure screenings, a growing trend. A recent report from consulting company Avalere Health, a D.C.-based firm that focuses on healthcare business and policy, found, quote, pharmacist roles have expanded to include more direct patient care, such as primary care and disease management. In Indiana, pharmacists may also, with the doctor's go-ahead, give flu shots and shots for shingles, pneumonia, and whooping cough. A new bill, which passed the state Senate and is now in the House, would add 5 more vaccinations to the list. 32 states allow pharmacists to deliver any vaccine approved by the CDC. Other states, such as Indiana, can administer a limited list of vaccinations.
But the doctor prefers this one.
But that new rule has sometimes created a tension between physicians and pharmacists.
But I like that one.
Like in this scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm, where Larry David asks, who's in charge?
Doctor? Pharmacist.
When does access create more issues than good is the question I think that needs to be asked.
Scott Gartneman is the director of healthcare policy at the Indiana State Medical Association. Gartneman says it's not about whether a pharmacist knows how to give a vaccine correctly. Students learn how to do that procedure in school, and every person administering vaccines needs to be certified. Rather, it's about a missed opportunity.
But if they're able to obtain these vaccines at a pharmacy, perhaps they don't go to see a physician, and something else is missed that is more pressing.
Preventative care trips are the basis of doctor-patient relationships, he says, and a la carte treatments from pharmacists just don't cut it. But pharmacists say it's not either or. Instead, it's this and. Purdue Pharmacy School head of pharmacy practice, Alan Zillick, says when pharmacists get more involved, the resulting care is more comprehensive and holistic. That's particularly true, he says, when it comes to the growing collaboration between doctors and pharmacists who have begun working in cooperative teams.
We really provide an extension of that physician's care.
All sides do agree on one thing. Pharmacists are just a lot easier to get to. practically every town has a CVS or Walgreens. In contrast, the number of general practitioners is shrinking. A recent study found 25% of Hoosiers are living in an area with a doctor shortage.
Pharmacies are much more accessible than any medical office. They're in small towns and big towns and on lots of street corners.
One can see a pharmacist without scheduling an appointment, and they're usually open outside of regular office hours.
At Kroger, you can have your prescriptions filled while you shop, so it's easy.
Indeed, there's an undeniable ease to a retail pharmacy, like the one I met Kroger's Jennifer Burley in suburban Fishers. One can pick up their Vicodin in the same place where they can buy an avocado or an umbrella.
So I think it's more of just adding that additional visit in between when they should be seeing the physicians versus necessarily taking an entire visit away.
However, if doctors want to maintain a stronghold on providing treatment, they might need to focus on becoming as easy to access as a corner pharmacy. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Sarah Fenton.
The Hoosier Environmental Council estimates that more than half of Indiana's streams and rivers would be no longer protected if President Donald Trump scraps the Waters of the U.S. rule. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that Trump signed an executive order yesterday that he says paves the way for eliminating those regulations.
The rule dictates which bodies of water are subject to federal clean water regulations. Indiana is one of several states challenging the current interpretation, which is under a stay. Indra Frank is director of environmental health and water policy for the Hoosier Environmental Council. She says the regulations are necessary and took years to finalize.
We feel it would be a waste of government resources to redo all of that work and rewrite it.
But the Indiana Farm Bureau wants to see changes to Waters of the U.S. Director of Government Relations Justin Schneider said in December, the rules place an unnecessary burden on farmers by forcing them to get permits for some daily activities.
Saying you have to get a permit and you're going to follow this, you know, kind of this blanket cookie cutter approach that we generally fall under, I don't think it works.
Schneider says changing or eliminating Waters of the U.S. would require starting a new rulemaking process. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Indiana's first female sheriff is the subject of a play that is going to be performed in Crown Point this weekend. It's a play that was written decades ago, but it's just now coming to the stage, even if it is one that's being set up in the Mackey Ballroom of the historic old courthouse in downtown Crown Point. I talked with the man who wrote the play and is directing it, Marion Kellum, and first asked him about the importance that Lillian Holly plays in Lake County history.
I came to Crown Point in 1959, and I'm out walking around town as a young man, a teacher at the high school, and I read about Dillinger and the jail, and which was still being used as a jail, and the sheriff's house was there and so forth, and I got really interested in it, and then I realized right away that people in town didn't want to talk about it. They were very leery of saying anything about the escape because of the embarrassment that it had caused at the time. But it struck me that, and the more I learned about Lillian Holly, what an admirable character. And here she is, a woman, when women had very few opportunities to have much of a control over anything. She's suddenly the sheriff of a pretty lively county with lots going on in it. And I had daughters, and I thought they need, and I had girls in class. So I was teaching a drama class, and I said, I was assigning them, pick up somebody, a celebrity or a historical figure or a politician, and just do a little scene, create a little scene, be that person for a few minutes. And the girls were having trouble coming up with it. And I said, well, what about Lillian Holly? And there was this silence in class. They didn't know her name. And I thought, this is not right. So I got the idea, maybe I should just write a little play, and we would do that at the high school. So I talked to several people, and they said, well, Lillian's not going to like that. So I wrote her a letter, and I explained everything that I just said. And my friends, George Pyle, a lot of other people that knew her personally, said, she's not going to talk to you. You've got to know that. She called me on the phone about 3 weeks later. I'd forgotten all about it. And she talked at length. She was very kind and explained, you know, about the grand jury and everything, you know, what the guards actually saw. Did they see a real gun? Did they see a wooden gun? And I was thrilled. I was just, well, I was thunderstruck. And she was so kind to me. But the last thing she said was, I don't want you to write the play.
Why did she want you not to write the play?
Their feeling after the escape, the town really came around her like a shield. She did not want to discuss it anymore. She had, for months after, in fact, extending to years. I came in 59, so that's what, 20 years after the escape, at least. They were still, there were authors and movie people, and so still calling her and trying to get her to speak, to give them some kind of permission to have the inside story about, and it was all about Dillinger. Well, the town got really sick and tired of their words, glorifying Dillinger, and, you know, the whole nation, the world, looked at Crown Point and her, our woman sheriff. We were an embarrassment. They criticized her as if she had somehow failed. She had done something wrong that caused this to happen. So nobody wanted to talk about it, including her.
Now, what does it turn out in what you had in your, not only your conversations with Lillian, but what you may have done in research as well, too, as to why these things happen? Why did it seem that everybody in Crown Point at the time was embarrassed about this? Was there any fault that could be laid upon the sheriff's department at the time?
I personally don't think so. I've done a lot of research. I've read a number of books. A man who really was closely allied, knew Louis Paquette, who was Dillinger's lawyer. And he took extensive notes when Dillinger would meet with Louis, all the whole inside story of that. Assuming that this document, this manuscript that just turned up not too long ago, it seems very real to me. And there was really a conspiracy of the Dillinger gang made connections with pretty crooked police officers and politicians in East Chicago, and they set the whole thing up. They really had it all very carefully planned. Now, Louis Paquette absolutely forbade any of them to smuggle a real gun into the place. But he found out about a case in Wisconsin where a convict there had whittled a gun and just, you know, convinced everybody that it was a gun by, you know, he'd stick it in somebody's back. You don't know, if you don't know it's a gun, you don't want to take the chance of getting the guy angry. So the guy was able to walk right out of prison. So he said that will work, you know. And so they had a gun made and took it in there. There's real evidence that a jail guard named Blunk was the first one taken. Dillinger got him first. Now, Blunk, of course, insists that he assumed there was a gun, and he surrendered his keys and his weapon to Dillinger because he didn't want to get shot. But there's some real suspicious idea. He definitely knew the people that we suspect in East Chicago. Well, for instance, Zarkovich. I don't know if you know, but Zarkovich is the police detective East Chicago who contacted the FBI later after the escape, and he was starting to get nervous about his connection being connected, and he got them connected with the lady in red, the mm-hmm. woman who, you know, so they could figure out where Dillinger was going to be at a particular place and time, and of course in front of the Biograph Theater. So Zarkovich and Blunt knew each other well, worked together in a lot of things, and that's the theory that I'm going with. There are a lot of theories out there. Mine is not and it isn't mine. It's from this particular book.
We're talking with Marion Kellum, a resident of Crown Point, who has talked to the sheriff named Lillian, which is hence the name of the play that this being put on at the old historic courthouse in downtown Crown Point. And we in turn found out here at least a little background as to the jailbreak at the Lake County Jail when it was downtown in Crown Point at the time. We know now it's the impetus in getting together the ideas and the information to create the play. And fast forward to 2017. Obviously, at the time you say that Lillian didn't want the play to be written, and obviously you probably had to wait until her passing to be able to bring it to light now, didn't you?
And wonderfully, as you know, she is an outstanding person in so many ways. She died at 103.
So, which is why it's taken so long from the 1950s to be able to finally put this
on.
That's
right. And she had twin daughters, as you may well know. And the daughters, the one daughter was in the Coast Guard during the Second World War and she retired from that as a lieutenant commander, I think she was. She rose in rank. A woman in the Coast Guard, very unusual. So it was a family of outstanding women. When she came back to Crown Point, she continued to live with her mother all that time and was very much, they were very close and they worked together well, as did the twin sister, married and lived in Pennsylvania, but was in and out. The daughter, Janet, died, 17 days, I think it was, within a week and a half after Lillian died. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting.
Which is not unusual for family members who are so close like that. You hear about that all the time with husbands and wives that have been married for 50, 60, 70 years longer. And
they're each other's support.
That's right. They've lived together. They've been together so long. They can't hardly think of themselves as not being a couple, I suppose.
I think that's right. Yeah.
When the opportunity finally presented itself now to be able to put the play on, let's talk about some of the obstacles that you run into, and when you put on a small production in a small place like the courtroom at the historic courthouse in Crown Point.
Oh, that's right. It's not a theater, and it doesn't have grid work in the ceiling to hang lights, and it doesn't have we have to create a sound system. We have to set a stage in the middle of a ballroom that's used almost every weekend for wedding receptions. And it's a beautiful room. It's hardwood floors and beautiful brass chandeliers, which, by the way, were contributed by Lillian Holley. She was on the ground floor of helping to restore the courthouse when we got it from the Lake County politicians. And they had let it run down. I mean, they knew they were moving out. They didn't want to put taxpayer money into preserving something that they weren't going to use anymore. And so when we started restoring it, we knew we had to make it some way useful mm-hmm. so that we could keep bringing in money to keep it under in repairs. And so she saw this room that we were going to make in a ballroom, and she bought those brass chandeliers. And also, the 4 clocks on the clock tower. Mm-hmm. You can see them from I-65. You can see, they're the center of that town. They're the heart of the town. Well, for years they hadn't worked. It takes money to repair them, and the politicians didn't do that. She found a company that works on such huge clocks and huge machinery and gears. I've been up there. It's an amazing mechanism. She got that company there, and not only that, but she'd go up and supervise them too.
Well, tell us about the play, Lillian, since we have an idea of what the play is about here, talking about Lake County Sheriff Lillian Holley and your conversations and the writing of the play and the like. Tell us about how it was, I won't say difficult, but certainly challenging to say the least in being able to cast such a play like this.
It is difficult to cast it. This is a typical example. Lillian had twin daughters, and the focus of the play is not on Dillinger. Of course, the escape figured in Lillian's life very much, but I'm showing the family life, their concern about their daughters, the relationship between she and Roy, her husband, and his nephew, Carol. And so I knew that during the years of the escape, I start the play when he is unexpectedly elected sheriff. He was a dentist, a very successful, popular dentist in Gary and Hammond. And the Democratic Party said, we need to fill a slot. They're not going to win, but would you please run for sheriff? So he did. And surprise, surprise, he won and served his first term very, very well. Well, the daughters, by the time of the escape, were 18. So I naturally wanted, if I'm starting in about 28 or so when he was getting elected, that's when I start the play, they would have been, you know, with a few years younger than that. No, not younger than 12, certainly. So I'm looking for girls like that age. Well, the high school right now is doing a wonderful, wonderful production, by the way, of Kiss Me, Kate. Mm-hmm. And they're wonderful actresses out there in Crown Point. They're, you know, any actress who wants, they want to be in that musical, of course. I could not find two teenage girls to do, but I found two delightful. Oh, they're the sweetest, cutest little buttons. But they're only like 10. Mm-hmm. And they're great little actresses. They really, I've never worked with children that young before. But
they're just not 12 years old. And obviously, so just have to work around that,
I had to work around that. And if members of the family come, by the way, just recently, one of Lillian's granddaughters, I think the only one, in fact, called me from California and said, what about this play? I hope you're going to be, you know, do honor to her and so forth. And I said, don't worry, Doreen, get everybody's name spelled right. Well, she wouldn't be happy to find out that I portrayed her mother in the play, Lillian's daughter, as 10 years old when, in fact, she was 19. But we have to do what we have to do to get a production on the ground.
So we are all set for the play now. Tell us a little bit about when it's going to be on here and some of the particulars, too, what people need to know to be able to get their tickets to be able to attend this event at in the ballroom at the courthouse.
Well, thank you very much for asking that question. That's why I'm here. You can go online and get tickets at Brown Paper Tickets. It's www.brownpapertickets.com. That's just fine. Or you can call the Historic Lake County Courthouse Foundation, and that number is 663-0660. The tickets are $25 for adults, and we've got a special $15 ticket for students. We haven't done that in the past, but we feel that this play, we're hoping that younger people will get to see it and get information about it.
Are you hoping that when Lillian comes before everybody there in the ballroom of the historic old courthouse in Crown Point, maybe it won't necessarily create a resurgence of interest in Lillian Holly, but at least we'll bring some interest back in this historical time, despite the fact that it was an embarrassment to the people of Crown Point?
That's exactly what I want to do. I think we should honor our figures in history. And Lillian Holly she's a wonderful person. She is a great people that I would like for our young people to know about. And we should respect that history, and we should be truthful, but know that she stood up very bravely in a very difficult situation. And her words, I quote her again and again in the play, stand by themselves.
The play Lillian will be performed Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Mackey Ballroom, which is in the historic old courthouse in downtown Crown Point. Kyle Meredith talks to Guy, not just any guy, on the Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
I am a huge Elbow fan. Love every record they've put out. Guy Garvey's voice, the cinematic quality of their songs, lyrics, and movements, it all hits me in, you know, that way you want music to hit you. Their new album, Little Fictions, has all of those qualities and comes at a time when people might need it most. It's an album of aural optimism in a time of arguments and challenges. But still, it's even more than that, as you'll hear in my conversation with Guy. I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound.
I will fly swift and I
won't traipse into your personal life here, but the last time we spoke, you had, I think, just gone through like a divorce, and now I hear that you're newly married.
That's right. the word doesn't slow down, does it, for anybody?
So
I got married in June. I've married the most beautiful girl I've ever seen, Rachel Sterling. She's an actress. She's the daughter of Diana Rigg.
Well, congratulations. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm a very happy man. It's all going very, very well.
In your arms,
gentle storm. Well, that must be why I'm fairly certain that you're the only musician putting out optimistic lyrics right now.
Well, you know, that was a conscious decision on the part of the whole of Elbow, you know, with things being so desperately dark as they are and have been, not just for 2016, they've been desperately dark for a decade now. Mm-hmm. In the past, I think we've been conscious that if there were too many celebratory, uplifting, hopeful songs on a record, maybe we'd be like, is that cool? Or is that, you know, is the balance right with the record? Or is it too uplifting, too pleasant? And then this time I was like, you know, there's never been a more important time than to try and inspire hope in people and try and lift their spirits, even for the duration of a pop song is, you know, it's something we felt we needed to do. First to put a simple truth in words
binds the world in a feeling all familiar. Well, and you know, we get into the first single, especially Magnificent. You've always written in such a cinematic way, I guess, but this song really does read like a screenplay. Like, I can see the movie happening right there.
That's very kind of you, Kyle. Yeah, I was on my honeymoon in Sardinia. And every morning I was being woken up by the sounds of kids playing in the edge of the sea. There is no better sound to wake up to, you know. And the idea of a little girl stood at the edge of the sea, this vastness and this, you know, innocent little girl. I thought, yeah, we could all do with that trust, with that open-mindedness and that, you know, babies share their food naturally. If you go near a baby that's eating, put your face close enough, it'll share its food with you. It takes quite a lot of hard work to turn us into hardened, hating people, you know. Throwing both the arms around the world.
The world that doesn't even know how much it needs this little girl. It's all gonna be magnificent.
I do talk and sing about my politics on the record. The song K2, for instance, was written before Britain decided to leave the European Union and after, before the Brexit vote and after. And my utter despair with the decision that was made, and everybody I know, actually, their utter despair at leaving Europe and, you know, and getting involved with Donald Trump, as our elected leaders seem to be doing now, it's just appalling. So there's bits of that on it, and there's a whole lot of love as well. Yes, and I'm given to believing in love. I've written the word in my blood,
and I perch on a shelf of the K2. And then I'll turn to the second single, too, with All Disco, which, you know, I've read that you guys were sort of looking back at the 60s in that, and if that's true, then the first time I heard it, I could hear the Youngbloods' Let's Get Together.
Yeah, and we threw in some Velvet Underground as well. And the chorus lyric on All Disco was inspired by Frank Black of the Pixies.
Oh, right.
You know, I asked him where his musical direction was going, and he said, oh, soul, punk, art rock, it's All Disco. And that, it just always stuck with me. Come to the river shore. Let your obsession go. What does it prove if you die for tune? It's really your disco. I couldn't have written that chorus a few years ago. I couldn't have written those words convincingly. But I heard of a young musician, a British musician I admired very much and I played on my programme, dying. And I could hear in his music quite how much of himself he was putting into his songs. And it really affected me. And for the next couple of days, I was properly jarred by this. I'd never met the guy. Mm-hmm. But I've been a young man in music. I've been a young man who wasn't succeeding in music. And it crosses your mind as a career option to die, given the sort of crazy complexity of how people react to dead musicians, the way they're held up and revered. And that's what prompted me to write the song, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was so heavy and it was so dark. And I was like, let's lighten this up with a bit of joie de vivre.
Oh, anywhere. It's looking like a beautiful day.
The newest Elbow album is called Little Fictions and should definitely be on your to-listen list. And thanks to Mr. Guy Garvey for the phone call. For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound.
And you hear Kyle Meredith with the Speed of Sound here on Regionally Speaking as we are now, as of today, wrapping up the second season of the programs. On Shelf Discovery, 10-year-old Nori Horace and her friends in the Upside Down Magic class continue to learn about their unusual magic on this edition of Shelf Discovery.
Keep your raincoat and your fire extinguisher handy, because this week's Discovery does some unpredictable magic with a bunch of lovable misfits. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. In Upside Down Magic, the first book in their magical series for kids, authors Sarah Malinowski, Lauren Miracle, and Emily Jenkins introduced readers to a class full of magical misfits. In the audio edition of the follow-up, Sticks and Stones, these lovable kids face yet another obstacle in their education. The story catches up with the kids of the Upside Down Magic class as they continue on their quest to fit in. As 10-year-old Nori Horace works to control her unpredictable magical abilities, she finds a new calling in a sport where her differences could actually be an advantage. And as a group of rival students petitions to have them removed from the school, the UDM kids must once again work together to prove that it's okay to be different. Now, the second book in this magical kids series isn't quite as heartbreaking as the first, focusing less on Nori's abandonment by her father. But that doesn't mean that the series has turned a corner and is suddenly bright and cheery. This time, it's poor Bax and his family who are struggling, and the kids in the UDM class continue to face all kinds of prejudice and bullying. But of course, it's not all doom and gloom here. The characters are adorable, their magical differences offer plenty of laughs, and their friendship and determination are inspiring. Sticks and Stones also continues to develop the delightful characters in the Upside Down Magic class, especially sweet but troubled Bax. And after learning to accept her differences in the first book, Nori begins to discover more of the benefits of her wonky magic. She's stronger and growing more sure of herself, and that makes her the kind of main character that kids will admire. But is it worth catching up with these magical outsiders? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it. Sticks and Stones is slightly lighter than its predecessor, but it still tells an enchanting story about a bunch of lovable underdogs and their battle for acceptance. It's a cute series with an important message for young readers. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. Sticks and Stones by Emily Jenkins, Sarah Malinowski, and Lauren Miracle is 3 hours and 9 magically amusing minutes long and is available from Scholastic Audio. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are worth their often limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard here on Regionally Speaking, as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book, sometimes an audiobook like this one. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today, and for tomorrow's program, we bring you the entire broadcast of the Community Forum on Executive Power and the Immigration Issue that was held on Tuesday evening at Purdue University Northwest's Hammond Campus. That's on tomorrow's Regionally Speaking. We'll be back with you with a new program on Monday.